The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So this morning, I thought of talking about one of the ways that the Buddha is described. There's said to be many different qualities that the Buddha manifests, and one is this quality, the Pali term is Lokavidu, which means the world knower, the one who knows the world. And I like this phrase, the knower of the world. And we need to understand what is meant by that. And it can help us in terms of understanding our own experience to reflect on what it means to know the world. When we think of knowing the world, typically we think of things out there. You know, we think of the world out there. But the Buddha's description of the world is, it is in just this fathom-long carcass endowed with perception and mind that I make known the world. So he's really pointing to the world of experience as being the world that is known. And if we think about it, if we think about how we know the world, how do we know what's happening out there, is only through this body, through the sense doors of the seeing, smelling, hearing, tasting, touching, and the fact that we have a mind that knows, perceives, thinks, and feels. So essentially, the world out there, we can't know about it in the abstract. We can only know about it in the way that it impacts our mind and body. And that's what we can know. We can know it completely and know it thoroughly. And that's what the Buddha, what is meant by the Buddha being a knower of the world. So we're interested in understanding the world, not through turning our attention to what's out there, but through turning our attention to our experience. What does it mean to see, hear, smell, taste, touch, think, feel, perceive, know? It's possible to understand these processes. Typically, when we engage in the world, when we experience the world and sense the world, what happens to us is that we get bound up by what we like and what we don't like. When we experience the world out there, we like certain things and we want them. We don't like certain things and we want to get rid of them. So we are often turned outwards towards this world of objects, trying to arrange it and to manipulate it, control it, so that it maximizes our pleasant experience as much as possible. Having this relationship with the world causes us some difficulty, because we have this relationship with the world, this controlling relationship to arrange it. We end up encountering the inevitable fact of impermanence and the inability to really control things. There's a quote from Rainer Maria Rilke. And we, spectators, always, everywhere, turned toward the world of objects. It fills us. We arrange it. It breaks down. We rearrange it, then break down ourselves. Because we cannot control the world, we suffer through this endless trying to arrange and rearrange the world. It's not a mistake that the world can't be rearranged to our satisfaction. It's just the way it is. So there's that fact of impermanence in the world of experience that we typically want to ignore, pretend like it doesn't exist. Well, at least for a little while, for a few moments here, I can arrange the world the way I like it. And then, maybe for the next few moments, when that one breaks down, I'll rearrange it. And then, I'll rearrange it. I'll just keep rearranging, endlessly, endlessly rearranging the world. And we get caught in this cycle. So that seeing the world and not acknowledging this truth of impermanence causes us to suffer. Another way that we suffer around seeing the world is that we interpret pretty much everything that we experience in terms of me, mine, and I. Everything that comes in is my house, my car, my food, this thing to eat. I am a happy person. I am an unhappy person. I like this. I don't like that. Pretty much everything that we experience is interpreted through our filter of I, me, and mine. So some things we like, we want to have them, we want to eat them, we want to possess them, own them, keep them. Feelings we have, a feeling of happiness, we want to make it continue. We feel like that is the way it's supposed to be. And somehow that something is wrong with me if it's not always that way. So this interpretation of the world, these two aspects of interpreting the world, one in terms of ignoring the fact of impermanence, and the other in terms of interpreting everything as it relates to me, both of these cause us a lot of suffering. When we have something that belongs to me, we often get, because it's mine, we feel like we have to somehow keep it or strategize to keep it. So there's some stress around that strategizing. If something happens to things that are mine, they get lost, stolen, broken, we suffer because they're no longer with us. We are attached to things. And we're attached to ways we feel, both positive and negative, actually, surprisingly. We get very attached to feeling happy and feeling good and think that's the way it's supposed to be. But we're also actually attached to those miserable states as well. We think or identify ourselves as being depressed or miserable, frustrated or angry. I'm an angry person, I'm a frustrated person, I'm a miserable person. We see ourselves from that perspective. In seeing ourselves from a certain perspective, we actually limit our capacity to notice when something else is happening, to notice when we're not miserable or frustrated or depressed. Those ideas about who I am limit us. It's like putting on a view or a filter of this is me. And then when we look at the world, we see everything that confirms that. I'm reading a book called My Stroke of Insight. Some of you may have heard of this book. It's a really interesting book by a woman named Jill Bolte Taylor. And she had a stroke in the left side of her brain. And in that process of that stroke happening in the left side of her brain, she began to experience the right side of her brain as being open, connected, peaceful, essentially a kind of an enlightenment experience. And as her left brain came back up online, as her left brain healed, she began to notice the ways in which her mind told her things. You know, this is the way you are. Kind of the programs that we have in our left brain around habitual tendencies. You know, that when we experience something, it hooks into various patterns that we have formed around that experience. So there's some various functions in the left side of our brain that tend to get us kind of derailed. These patterns that hook us, they're the patterns that hook us into emotional responses, those identities that we have of being angry or frustrated or miserable. That when we get close to those patterns, they just hook in and spin and reinforce that pattern. In addition to that, she says that the left brain, she was not just a normal, normal person when she had the stroke. She was a neuroanatomist. So she knew what her brain was and how it functioned. And as she watched it disintegrate, she understood what was happening in her brain. And one of the pieces of her left brain, she says that the left brain is an amazing search and find machine. And if you're looking for red, you will find red everywhere. It's like a filter that we put on our mind. That there's a part of the left brain that knows how to do that. Search and find, search and find. So essentially it's like a view which filters everything else out. This happens with personality traits, you know, a feeling of being miserable. Everything we see confirms, oh yes, I'm miserable. Yeah, I'm miserable. It happens with visual things. I had this experience just the other day. I went to have breakfast with a friend in Menlo Park at Cafe Baroni. And when we finished breakfast, we went down to the parking garage and we were looking for her car. And we couldn't find her car. We both had kind of a memory of where she had parked. Sort of. I mean, she couldn't remember at all where she'd parked, and I kind of had a vague sense of where she'd parked. And we looked around that area. We could not find her car. We ended up walking through the entire garage, looking at every car. We couldn't find her car. We started thinking, okay, car's been stolen. Car's been stolen. Okay, I started thinking about walking home. She started thinking about calling the cops. After we'd pretty much walked the whole garage, it suddenly occurred to me, we'd brought my car. And we just both cracked up. It's like, wow, you know, there's a perfect example of that filtering. We'd walked by my car several times and not seen it. So the brain does this kind of thing. Simple, amusing ways and in some kind of poignant, heartbreaking ways. So there's one powerful teaching that really speaks to how to train our attention to the actual experience of the world, as opposed to through all these filters and views and ideas and opinions we have about the world. The Buddha suggests that it's helpful to see the world as it is, rather than as we think it should be. I'll read you the first part of this teaching, the context of this teaching. This is a very famous, often quoted passage in the Buddhist text, so some of you may have heard this before. And the context is one, an ascetic has come to the Buddha and basically has said, please teach me the teachings in brief. And the Buddha says, you should train yourself thus. In reference to the seen, there will be only the seen. In reference to the heard, only the heard. In reference to the sensed, only the sensed. In reference to the cognized, only the cognized. This is how you should train yourself. So essentially, this is talking about bringing our attention to our experience directly, essentially a bare experience, a bare attention, without the filter of ideas, thoughts, views, opinions about what we are experiencing. Now, this is simply expressed, this teaching, but very, very challenging to implement. Our minds have a very natural tendency, this left brain part of our mind, actually, of when we see something, immediately creating a story around it, particularly as it relates to me. This morning I noticed, I was playing with this a little bit and noticing, you know, okay, seeing the wall. And almost immediately it's my wall, my house. You know, boom! The wall relates to me. So it's very difficult that the pattern in the mind is to immediately move from what we experience into thoughts, stories, ideas around what we experience. So I'd like to explore this with you a little bit in just sitting here right now. We'll start with seeing. Just take in the fact that seeing is happening. Become aware that you're seeing. Notice what you are seeing. Form, color, edges, shapes, movement perhaps. You're probably also seeing objects like people, chairs, carpet, wall. That part is actually a concept. It's not the actual bare seeing. So just notice that seeing is happening. And see if you can now step back just a little bit from the things that you're seeing to notice how seeing is happening. There's many different ways that seeing can happen. You might be kind of taking in a broad spectrum of things, and kind of just settling back and just letting the sense of seeing happen. You might be looking at things. You might be looking at one thing for a while, focusing on something. You might be kind of shifting from thing to thing to thing. So there's different ways that seeing happens. And just noticing how the seeing is happening. And then and see if you can become aware. Settle back, relax, and see if you can notice kind of the process of seeing. Just the fact that the eye exists and seeing happens. You don't have to do seeing. The process of seeing just happens. It's almost like, you know, if you have glasses on, you know, the glasses are what make it possible for you to have things in focus in the world. We don't often think about the fact that we are wearing the glasses because we're looking through them. So see if, and the eye is like that, you know, so the eye is there. You know, the eye is the way that we are seeing the world. It's almost like settling back and recognizing the eye is how all of this information is coming in for seeing. Can you settle back and just recognize the process of seeing through the eye? And now turning your attention to hearing. Noticing what you are hearing. The sounds, subtle sounds, sound of my voice, sounds outside. Seeing if you can just stay connected with the experience of the hearing itself. What we actually hear is pitch and tone. There's probably also some recognition of what is heard. Car. Cough. That recognition process is separate from the hearing. So you might, particularly if you close your eyes while hearing, connecting to the experience of hearing, you might start to notice that there's the hearing, and then there's some kind of process that goes on to identify what has been heard. You may see an image of a train in your mind, or an image of a car. Just noticing that they're different things. And again, see if you can relax and just kind of recognize the process of hearing that's happening. The ear is there, sound waves come in, there's contact. The vibration of the eardrum produces sound, which the brain, the mind, interprets as car. The hearing is just the vibration. And can you relax and just notice that vibration? And turning your attention to your body, the physical experience of your body. Noticing whatever is obvious to you about your physical experience. Perhaps the pressure of your butt on the chair or cushion. Maybe vibration throughout the body. Heat or coolness on the skin, the light pressure of your clothes against your body, contact of your hands touching each other, or touching your body. You might notice movement in your body. Again, there's the process of the feeling, the sensing itself. And then there's something in the mind that recognizes it, categorizes it, labels it. Itch, pain. Wetness, coolness, heat. Or perhaps it labels it as broadly as foot, hand, shoulder, lips. Those are concepts. Can you, for a few moments, just settle in the actual experience, the actual felt sense of being alive? And turning your experience to your mind, to what's happening in the mind right now. Sometimes this can be unfamiliar. Is there a mood? Are there thoughts happening? A sense of calm, agitation, annoyance, irritation, ease, frustration, happiness, friendliness, confusion. Noticing that there's this process, this mental process happening. A thought appears, it can be known as a thought. A feeling appears, it can be known as a feeling. A perception appears, a recognition of something appears. It can be known as a recognition. In the seen is only the seen. In the heard is only the heard. In the sensed is only the sensed. In the cognized is only the cognized. This is how you should train yourself, the Buddha says. So getting to this point of bare attention, getting to the place where we can experience the seen as the seen, the heard as the heard, the sensed as the sensed, the cognized as the cognized. That's not easy, because as I said, immediately upon something coming in, and perhaps you saw this a little bit, particularly with hearing, seems to be the easiest place for people to begin to recognize this separation of the process of the hearing from the perceiving of the thing heard. So it's one of the easiest places to play with this. And immediately the sound we hear, get an image of a car. We may even envision the whole car. We may see the person who's turning on the ignition. Somehow we create that in our mind. And then we start thinking about it. We start relating it to us, or relating it to the kind of car we have or would like to have. this is a process, it's a natural process that happens in the mind, and we confuse it with the actual experience of hearing. So it's part of what the Buddha is pointing to, is beginning to see what is the actual experience and where does the mind take off and create the world from that actual experience. Another thing that the woman who wrote the book My Stroke of Insight mentions is that the left brain is brilliant at working with incomplete data. It knows how to fill in the gaps. It knows how to come up with theories and ideas about what things are with very little information. And it believes it's found the truth when it's done that. And really wants to convince us, essentially, oh, this is it, this is the truth. So beginning to see how this works, how our mind takes in experience and then constructs something, and actually then asks us to believe it, all of this is stuff that can be known. It's not that we're trying to stop this process, because we have to live in the world. Our left brain was designed to fill in incomplete information so we can navigate the world. So it's not that we're trying to stop that process, but we're trying to recognize it for what it is, hypothesis. That helps us, but doesn't necessarily represent actuality. So coming to this place of bare attention is challenging. And there's some ways that we can support our investigation along these lines. One of them being something I talked about the last time I was here, which is checking into what our view or interpretation or our filter is on the world, that as we are looking at it, as we are seeing things, as we are hearing things, do we have some kind of a filter that we're looking through? Are we frustrated? Are we looking through the frustration filter? Are we irritated or annoyed and looking through that filter? Do we think we're right and we're looking through that filter? So just checking in, you can actually just simply ask yourself, how am I relating to experience? Another way to ask the question, what's my attitude about what's happening? These are ways to reveal to us some of these filters that are held, that sometimes are so close to us that we don't recognize we're holding them. We don't recognize that we're looking through this filter of I'm right, because that's the way we always look at the world. We don't recognize we're looking through a filter of aversion because it's so familiar to us. So asking the question can begin to reveal these views to us, reveal these filters. When we have those filters revealed to us, now they don't necessarily go away when we notice them, but we at least have the opportunity to recognize my experience is filtered here. My experience is I'm seeing things through this pattern, this familiar habit. Sometimes we can, and that itself, that recognizing I'm seeing through this is helpful. It's like it. We know that we're seeing that way, and something about that recognition helps us to kind of balance out a little bit. Okay, I know that I'm experiencing anger, so everything I look at looks like it's bad news. Just to know that supports our taking a step back from it. And sometimes we can actually even, instead of looking through that filter of anger, actually look at the anger itself. Then what happens, you know, so we're seeing things or hearing things through this filter of anger. We're noticing then that we have this anger. And then we turn towards the anger itself. What does it feel like to be angry? There's the experience of the physical body. There's the experience of the mind that's angry. What we're then doing is looking at the cognized. We're looking at what's happening in our minds and how it impacts our body. Another great little thing from this book, My Stroke of Insight, is as a neuroanatomist, she understands and points out that when a particular emotion hits, it triggers a release of hormones, of chemicals into the body that create the feeling of that emotion. So something happens and anger arises, and that the mind releases those chemicals. We feel heat, pressure, tension, tightness in our bodies. Now she says that initial release of chemicals washes through within 90 seconds. And it's only continued if we stay hooked into the loop of anger. If we stay hooked into the thoughts around it. If we feed it through thinking about it, he did, she did, they shouldn't have done, I should have done. If we stay hooked into that, we keep flushing those chemicals through our body. And so the feeling of the emotion continues. If you can, in experiencing that hit of that chemical rush through your body, just hang out for 90 seconds. Hang out in the feeling of anger, heat, tension, tightness. Just recognize that this is a chemical process happening in the body. Can I hang out with it for 90 seconds? If it lasts more than 90 seconds, she says, you're feeding it. So that's been a very interesting exploration for me, just to kind of know that piece of information is really helpful. And there's one piece I want to add to that, because I have experienced in my own practice times when something flooded my experience like that. And you know, just being with it, and then having the insight or recognition, this is just caused by thinking. You know, it's like it's just a pattern of thought arising in the mind that's creating this feeling. And for me at that point, it was self-hatred, the feeling of self-hatred. That recognition in that split second, I didn't have to wait 90 seconds. It was gone, and the body was flooded with a feeling of bliss. So I just want to point this out, because if you have the idea that you have to wait the 90 seconds, that can kind of hook you in to it a little bit. So, you know, sometimes the insight into a pattern can just cut it like a knife instantaneously. And I don't know what's happening in the brain that it can do that, but I know from experience it can. So this checking the attitude, checking what's the relationship to experience, is one way to begin to back into the direct experience of the moment. What's actually happening? What's seen, what's heard, what's sensed, what's cognized? Another place, or another way to work with this, to reflect on this, is to play with something that is suggested in many, many places. The Buddha suggests in many places. He says that as you're experiencing something, as you're seeing something, reflect, actually consciously think. The Buddha actually recommends thinking at times. He recommends thinking skillfully. He says, reflect, this is not me, this is not mine, this is not who I am. Around things that are seen, probably mostly we need to reflect, this is not mine. Around things that are heard, perhaps also, this is not mine. Around moods, opinions, views, thoughts, this is not me, this is not who I am. Bringing in that thought, it helps to break us out of these identities we have. You know, I'm a miserable person. Miserableness comes up. I'm a miserable person. This miserableness is not me. It's a pattern of chemicals firing in the brain and the body. It comes and it goes. There are probably some patterns that we each have that happen more frequently. Those are the ones we identify with. We take to be me. We take to be mine. So bringing this reflection in, consciously reflecting, this is not me, this is not mine, this is not who I am, can help us to support this movement to just the seen, just the heard, just the sensed, just the cognized. The last part of this teaching that I started reading in reference to the seen, there will be only the seen, points very directly to this. This is not me, this is not mine, this is not who I am. And what I like about this teaching is that basically he keeps pointing us back to just see if you can notice what's seen. Can you let go of the filters and views that are in the way of what's seen? Notice what's heard. Can you just be with what's heard? Notice what's sensed. Can you just be with what's sensed? Notice what's thought, imagined, felt, emoted. Can you just be with that? And he says, here's the result. When for you, there will be only the seen in reference to the seen, only the heard in reference to the heard, only the sensed in reference to the sensed, only the cognized in reference to the cognized, then there is no you in terms of that. When there is no you in terms of that, there is no you there. When there is no you there, you are neither here nor yonder nor between the two. This, just this, is the end of stress, the end of suffering. So actually, to me, this points to the fact that we don't have to believe this teaching around I'm not here, we don't have to believe that I'm not a miserable person, that I'm not a happy person, we don't have to believe that idea. He says that this training in terms of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, thinking, it's training to keep moving back, letting go of thoughts as much as possible around what's seen, heard, sensed. That itself, that process, will reveal to you there's no you in terms of that. There's no you there. And it's a strange sounding teaching. I admit it's a very strange sounding teaching. There's no you there. But you don't have to believe it. That's what I really want to point out to you. You do not have to believe that teaching. You don't even really have to think about it. I mean, it can be helpful if you can resonate with it at all. It can be helpful to bring it in and reflect, this is not mine. This is an impermanent passing phenomenon. This is not me, this feeling of anger. It's just a release of chemicals into cells. It can help to detach us from our identification. But we don't have to really believe it. Just this connecting with our direct experience will show us the truth, will show us things are impermanent. And things are not me, they're not mine, they're not who I am. So this bare attention, this training in bare attention points us to the essence of what it means to know the world. Knowing the world. Now, some of us, you know, to get to this place of bare attention, as I said, it's challenging because we have this immediate habitual movement to move out from our what we experience to our thoughts, to our repetitive patterns of thinking. And we all need to find our own way to navigate through that maze of our thoughts. Some of us can connect with our experience and begin to recognize as we're moving off from it. Some of us really get hooked into our thoughts, and we actually need to turn our attention away from the thoughts, grounding in some neutral experience, grounding in our breath, our body, using metta to help to settle, using loving kindness to help to settle our thinking process. So we're all different in how we have to navigate this landscape of our internal world. So this learning how to work with our thoughts, learning how to let go of our thoughts, whatever supports that for you, cultivate that. Cultivate that. A quote from he's a Burmese, his name sounds Burmese, a Burmese lay practitioner. He's talking about this term, knower of the world, Lokawi Du. And he says, the Buddha knows how clashes and harmony happen in this world. He knows why people can be trapped in them or be free from them. You are in harmony with the world only when you know about it and live accordingly, accepting it as it is. So those are my thoughts on knowing the world, a few of my thoughts on knowing the world. Are there any questions or comments or anything that you are interested in exploring? Yeah. Oh, let me pass the mic back. Sorry.
You spoke. You spoke quite eloquently about the right, the left brain. Do you have any thoughts about the right brain?
What I have been reading in this book, the right brain is apparently the part of the mind that takes things in intuitively, that takes things in as a whole, that it's not linear, logical, organized. It's much more deals with things in the present moment. The way this woman experienced life when her left brain was completely flooded with blood and basically non-functional was just as a fluid interconnection with the universe, a blissful state of peace. Now, I don't know if it's that way for everybody's right mind, right brain. She's really clearly speaking from her own experience. But, in kind of playing with it in reading this book, I mean, part of what I like about this is that it's very in line with some of the teachings of the Buddha around, and the commentaries and the teachers since the Buddha, around how our minds work and how we can free ourselves from all these habitual patterns. That essentially what Jill Bolte Taylor experiences is that there's this part of the mind that is directed towards peace, compassion, happiness, connection, wholesome things. The right part of the mind seems to be connected to those wholesome qualities of beautiful interconnection. And that those circuits are actually running all the time, but they are overwhelmed by our left hemisphere, which organizes, categorizes, places, figures out, structures, thinks, and gets into these patterns of, oh, I know this based on this small amount of information. This is true. So those patterns are so well trained in our culture in particular, and I think in general in human society, because we need those functions to navigate the world. They're so well trained that they kind of drown out that peacefulness. But there's one teacher, Ajahn Buddhadasa, who says that moments of non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion, or moments of bliss, little moments of awakening, happen all the time. And we just don't recognize them, we don't key into them, because they are so subtle, because we are habituated to experiencing much more obvious phenomena. And my interpretation or understanding of that, having read this book, is that those moments are happening continuously in the right brain. You know, the right brain is doing that pattern of peace, of connection, of feeling the world in that very intuitive, non-linear, non-verbal way. And the left brain is so noisy that it drowns it out. But it's happening all the time. It's happening. And my experience as I navigate my meditation and working with this teaching from Ajahn Buddhadasa around these moments happening all the time, I begin to connect or notice, oh yeah, you know, just moments where there's not much happening. And those moments are usually drowned out. But as the thoughts get quieter, as the left brain settles down and doesn't have to think so much, or realizes it doesn't have to think so much, we can feel more and more of that movement of kind of an inherent kind of peacefulness that seems to be there. She calls it, for herself, she calls it stepping to the right. You know, as she's experiencing something, she talked about how as her left brain came back, as, you know, her brain healed, she began to see as kind of functions came back, as the function of being a rational, linear, organized person began to come back, it brought with it some of these attachments of being arrogant and hostile. And she said she didn't want those. And she began to realize she had a choice. She could unhook from those. And it really is describing very much this process of noticing how we react to the world. The Buddha says, whatever one thinks or ponders, whatever one frequently ponders, that becomes the inclination of the mind. And this is very much how she describes the brain working, you know, that those patterns which have been frequently pondered, frequently hooked into, they came rushing back as her brain healed. And she had to let go of them over and over and over again, partly by doing this, what she called stepping to the right. stepping into that, which she had a very clear, very long experience of, that capacity of the brain to feel peace and oneness. So she had a little bit of an advantage on us in that she got a real great hit of that, familiarizing herself with that. We have to do it more little by little, just getting little tastes of it, and getting familiar with those little tastes of peace. Anyone else? Okay. Gary, could you hold on to it for a second? Yeah. Let's just sit, noticing, seeing. Allowing the seeing to be experienced just as it is. Noticing hearing. Noticing the body. Noticing the mind. Can you incline your mind to recognize that peacefulness? And just even don't try to find it, but just kind of settle back and recognize that as you're sitting here, seeing happens, hearing happens. Things in the mind happen, things in the body happen. Can you just allow the experience to unfold without getting in the way? Sort of relax and just notice what the mind is doing. It sees sometimes, it hears sometimes, it feels things in the body, it moves, it thinks, it feels, it perceives. And it has this capacity for peace, kind of always happening. Thank you for your attention.